LinuxQuestions.org presents LQ Radio, the number one online radio broadcast focusing on Linux and open source. And now, LQ Radio, open talk about open source.
Hello, and welcome to LQ Radio, episode number two. First off, I'd like to apologize. The delay in between the last episode and this episode is much longer than I had anticipated, and we won't be going this long in between shows in the future. We had a few unanticipated things come up, and it couldn't be avoided. But I'd expect a show probably every 2 to 3 weeks moving forward. So let me introduce the panel. As in episode number one, we have John and Dave, and subbing in for Robin this time will be Finnegan. So you already met John and Dave, so I'll let Christian introduce himself a little bit.
Oh, great. I'm subbing in for Robin, so I'm the middle relief pitcher. Oh, great. I feel so freaking special. My username on Linux Questions is Finnegan. I've been on the site since about, mid-2001. I guess it puts my user number down in the 4,000s. Not nearly as cool as Tricky, like 200-something, but, you know, hey, it took me a while to turn into a geek. I'm a sysadmin for a pretty medium-sized web hosting company. I don't even remember to fix the HCL, and then what do I do in the real world? I'm a sysadmin for about a medium-sized web hosting company, and I run Slackware on pretty much anything that can boot it. Except now I'm forced to run Gentoo on AMD64 because Slack doesn't run on that natively yet. Except for that guy in England's got a thing coming out, but, you know, I don't trust him. Yeah, that covers about it.
All right. Thanks, Finnegan. So
a few quick
general show updates. Hopefully this show sounds quite a bit better than last time. Since the last show, we got a noise gate, a compressor, upgraded mic, and a different mixer. So pretty much a completely new setup from episode number one. Do keep the feedback coming. We got a ton of feedback on episode number one, and Dave kind of wrote up a little document on how we're going to improve the show and what we're going to do. We weren't able to tie all the improvements into this show, but moving forward, hopefully by like episode three or four, we should be able to tie in his improvements, which I think should greatly improve the show. The one feedback that I did get quite a bit on the constructive criticism side is that the camaraderie kind of wasn't there compared to some of the other shows. A couple things to keep in mind there. I think of a lot of other shows, everyone's kind of in the same room, and they're friends, and they know each other, and they're kind of comfortable with each other. In the last show, the only two people that had even ever met each other were Robin and I, and I talked to Dave once, I think, on Skype just testing. John had never met any of us, so it'll probably take a while for that to kind of build up, but I would anticipate it. So that was pretty much the only criticism we got. I don't know if you guys saw anything else out there.
We are all just a bunch of internet strangers. No, I've met Jeremy. I know he's a complete wanker. And JT, you went to Georgia Tech, right?
Yeah, I did.
Yeah, so I know what you're like, you know. 15,000 email. There's 13,000 clones out there that are all like JT, and then there's like five women on this campus, and that's spooky.
So if nothing else, Finnegan should spice the show up a little bit this time.
Yeah, thanks. I'm what, the relief pitcher for the fact Robin couldn't hack it? Thanks, man. I feel so, you know.
Well, the panel consists of all of us, really. There's going to be regular sub-ins and outs. You weren't the relief for him, just he subbed out and you subbed in. You're all starters, don't worry.
Okay.
Kristen or Finnegan, you got big boots to fill because Robin had that golden throat. He's got that radio voice.
The man is dead sexy, actually. I met him in person. Robin is a big hunk of man.
I think I've dialed into the wrong show.
Yeah, on that note,
The great state of Iowa wept when he came and hung out with us in Boston for, what, four days, something like that? Yeah,
Robin and Christian were both at the last Linux World in Boston, so hopefully Dave and John will be able to make it to California. But we'll see. So,
someday when I grow up.
Yeah, someday.
Whoa. Is California back on?
No. Actually, California is not back on. I'm trying to to get a booth. So if we get any update on that, I'll let everybody know. So on that note, I'll move into LQ News. Since the last show, I have about four of them. LinuxQuestions.org didn't turn five since episode number one. Yeah, we've come much farther in 5 years than I ever would have anticipated. And once again, just want to thank all the members and moderators for making the site what it is. Story number two, the Drive to 3000 LQ Wiki articles continues. The wiki was down for a couple days, and it's back up now. We had some hardware problems, but the number of articles is steadily increasing, and we're slowly but surely making our way there. Next story, this is just one official a couple days ago. We are going to be a sponsor of the upcoming OSCON that O'Reilly puts on. It's, I think, August 1st through 5th in Portland. And hopefully I'll be going there. I'm not sure if any moderators will be joining me. Hopefully we'll have to see on that. And then the last story, LQ Bookmarks, which had been beta, we're just going to release right now here on the show. So as of right now, it's officially released and no longer beta. I would like to thank David Ross. Really, really worked his ass off on this. He was up until about 1:30 his time, helping me and working with me to put the final polish on it, and we added a couple last-minute features that were requested. So thanks, David. He did a great job. I think the site looks great. I don't know if you guys, have you had a chance to use it at all?
Well, I'm just surprised. Is there a hot spot in this pub?
No, he actually skipped the pub.
No.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. That's an imposter that it wasn't David.
Did the mad Scotsman. No, that just doesn't make sense. He was he nearly cried when we had to leave in London at, like, what, 10 o'clock closing laws or some sickness like that? I don't know.
Yeah, that was very strange. I was surprised in London that the pubs closed. Around here, they all close at 4 a.m.
Yeah.
Well, you can move on to the discos in London, though, right?
We actually had we had to take a cab to, like, I think it was Soho to have a place that was open until 2. Ended up being like a 40-pound cab ride from our hotel.
Boy, you, ouch.
Yeah.
Yeah. In American dollars, it's like a toe.
Yeah.
Anyway, yeah. Right, I just remember, doing the equivalent, like $3 cup of coffee. All right, I'm.
That's like a good $5.
Yeah, you know.
All right, so I think that wraps up the LQ News. So we're going to move right into stories. And Finn, we'll start with you.
Okay. Well, actually, it's not nearly as much of a story. I do have a story ready, and then I have some other things to talk about. The one thing that John. The one thing that Dave and I were talking about the other day on IRC was the one thing we thought was lacking a little bit was too much preaching to the choir. We thought there needed to be a little more contention. So you had to come up with a subject that I knew that Dave or I and you would violently disagree on. Sorry, John.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, and the one that we came up with was Linux on the desktop. Why the heck was the first show didn't circle around this, I don't know, because it's, like, what are you going to do, have an argument about VI or Emacs? That's just silly. It's like, talking Christianity.
Of course, VI all the way.
Oh, yeah, I mean, why would anybody ever use Emacs?
Okay, I don't know you guys, because, all the Emacs users are going to burn chickens in your lawn or something. Slowly the heck away from that one. But it's cool.
So what do you think the contention is going to be?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
What do you think the contention is going to be?
So Jeremy's opinion is, he'll have to tell me, because I don't put words in his mouth.
Well, you're starting out the story, so what is your opinion?
Will it ever be ready? When will it be ready?
I guess ready for who would be the question that I would have. I think on the desktop, it's been ready for me for years. My main desktop, I've used Linux probably since 2002 maybe. So clearly to me, it's ready. I can say I have loaded on my parents' machine, and they call me infinitely less than they used to when they had Windows on there, and they don't have any complaints at all. They're pretty much just Word and Firefox users. They definitely don't do anything out of the ordinary. For the Windows Power user that's used to some apps that probably don't run or have equivalents, no, it's probably not ready yet. I think we're making great strides, but it's going to be a little while. So that's my opinion. So feel free to violently disagree.
That was such a medium answer than I was expecting from Jer. Dave?
Well, okay. I have a couple of clients running at least one SUSE, unfortunately, desktop in their office. And there's been a few minor glitches, but the support for that has been much less than their XP stuff has required. On top of that, as far as installs go, you can look at Ubuntu or SUSE and compare that to a Windows XP install. And I just call it the dad test. My dad could not install Windows XP. He would have all kinds of grief, all kinds of questions. And even when he was done, he would still want to know why he can't need an Office document or something, because he just doesn't know that you have to actually load Office. Right. And whereas the steps you follow for a lot of the distributions now are just so easy. I mean, hardware detection, if it's supported, it will get detected properly. And conflict resolution in Linux is, from my experience, far easier than the mystery driver from the mystery Chinese manufacturer motherboard of God knows what chip hardware you have to is on that piece of kit. But in Linux, it's so much easier to troubleshoot. So I would have to say that. How's that for a non-answer?
Yeah, you danced around the campfire really well there, man.
Yeah, I did. Thank you. As far as Linux on the desktop, there are a lot of environments where people would just do, like Jeremy said, have a web browser, do some Word documents, the occasional spreadsheet. If someone's really locked into Office, and I should say that I'm a CodeWeaver's vendor, so I am biased, but so you can just tuck in a CodeWeaver's install and let your Office run on your Linux box. Those types of scenarios where it's an Office type setup where people just use typical Office applications, they're fine.
I think it's better already.
My customers don't install their own OS. I don't know about you guys, but they
almost nobody does.
I do a lot of desktop support.
People don't have Windows because they installed it. People have Windows because it came with their machine when they bought it. If they had Linux that came with their machine when they bought it,
but you don't get a disk.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's a whole new can of worms. When will they be allowed by Microsoft to put Linux on a box by default without losing some sort of cool licensing deals like that? I don't know. That one gets
I'm up against that all the time. I get people coming in saying, I can buy a Dell for $499, and I couldn't touch the hardware for that and make $20, let alone putting an OS on there. So you know Dell's got a sweet deal. You know they're not making all their margin on the hardware.
No, they make a significant amount of their money on the Windows techs.
Yeah, and of course their financing, which they're trying to talk everybody into. If you call Dell and you want to buy a, in our experience, it was a server, and for one client of mine who wanted to buy a notebook and a desktop box, they had to fight tooth and nail to just buy the thing and not finance it. They went through three tiers of salespeople to convince them that, no, I don't want to buy it. Or I don't want to lease it or finance it. I want to buy it.
Hmm. Well, I mean, who wouldn't want to pay $50 a month for their computer for the next 6 years?
But that's where Dell makes the money. But I'm not knocking Dell. I'm just saying that as a small vendor, believe me, I'm small, there's no way I can compete against those kinds of prices. I'm not complaining.
No, not on hardware. There's no way.
No, and the hardware and the OS, because no one wants to buy just a computer and a box. People that walk into my shop, you guys probably don't know what I do, but I do a lot of marine stuff, and guys are putting charting applications on their boats. I also do some home and office setups, but they don't really care what the computer is. They just want to be able to turn it on and poke at stuff and, you know, click on shiny buttons and type in the white in the white parts and do stuff.
Yeah, that was John, I'll let you answer in a second, but that kind of reminds me. I just went to GnomeDex, and it was kind of a reminder that I think I had forgotten how far outside the demographic of normal computer user I am. And that was kind of one of the focuses of the show, was that, you know, if you're in this room now, you have absolutely no idea what the normal computer user does because you haven't done it in so long that you probably don't even remember. And I think...
I don't even think I hang out with them anymore, actually.
And actually...
All my non-tech geek friends are, you know, elite snobs, so they all own Macs. So they're in an entirely different world on top of that. Which is, I don't know, yeah. Sorry, John, I'm having a hard time telling John and Dave apart. Sorry, we were talking about this before the show started. Did you already chime in?
No, John,
I have not yet. My opinion on the whole Linux desktop thing is I really think that it's ready for the people who are very basic users. I think it's ready for people like us that have just been using Linux for years. But again, it's the Windows power users that are really struggling. I think they're so used to using their tools and doing things their way, and have trouble installing software, and they have trouble figuring out where settings are and things of that nature. I'm not really sure how to go about fixing that problem.
And I think a lot of them are averse to change.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's not that
is a lot of the problem.
I don't think that Linux is any more complicated or the interface is necessarily worse, because I don't think the Windows interface is really that good. I mean, the question I would answer back with is Windows ready for the desktop? And I think Robin from Linux.com asked that question. Linux is at least as ready as Windows from a technical and almost every perspective except for application support. So I think the only probably really polished desktop OS is probably Mac OS, because Windows sure isn't there. If you put someone who never used Windows in front of Windows, they wouldn't know what was going on.
Oh, right. That's the whole truth there, yeah.
Actually, there's one big thing I think you're missing there, but in a second. Wait a minute. The thing that John brought up was really interesting, was the fact that what you're saying basically is, you know, your average dad user, where, you know, it's web browsing, email, and get on the web, period. The shallow end of the pool. That's where Linux pretty much can hang. There's no problem there.
Yeah, absolutely no problem there.
Then, of course, there's the deep end of the pool where we all are, you know, trying to do backflips and just, you know, occasionally drowning each other because it's funny. And but it's the Windows power users, all the cats in the middle of the pool, that, because to venture into the deep end, why? They've got what they need. And then you have the application support issue, which is huge. I mean, Macromedia or Adobe,
same company now.
Huge. Oh, that's right. Okay. Yeah. I have a hard time keeping track because, you know, I can use the GIMP. These guys have reported all their stuff to Linux. Well, then, it's going to get insane. But anyway, but the one thing I think Jeremy missed, hardware support. Because, you know, after all, the very guts of Linux is the kernel. And Linus decides to do some stuff that basically makes a whole lot of sense to us, but doesn't jive exactly in the world of Windows. For instance, one of the things I keep running across in the hardware forum is people that want to get their, you know, pseudo, not really a hardware RAID card working on a dual boot. And it's pretty much bloody well impossible. I mean, Dave and I have complained to each other about the PDC 202 series, now the 203 series for SATA. There is no native Linux hardware driver for that RAID, because it's not really hardware RAID. It's just a huge, whopping software RAID that's sort of just all in the driver.
But those cars suck. So the way if you're going to use one of those, just use software RAID.
Exactly.
But I mean, those cards are a waste of money anyways. Those cards are a waste of money anyways. You're just running the vendor software RAID instead of Linux software RAID. I mean, those cards offer you almost nothing.
Right, but can you dual boot a Linux software RAID and a Windows software RAID?
No, you can't. No.
There
you go.
Okay.
Yeah. But, I mean, I'm also in the situation where my former business partner picked up a Promise FX4000. And I hate to pick on them. I'm sure everyone's seen my rant on LQ about this. But the card is completely unsupported in Linux. It is a hardware RAID. It's completely full-on XOR.
There's actual like onboard cache. It's a real
It's a real RAID card. It's a real RAID 5, you know, 1, RAID 0, RAID 0 plus 1, yada, yada, yada. Zero support in Linux. Nothing. There are binaries, but they don't work. And the
it works for like five kernels, yeah.
Is it just that you can't manage it in Linux, or is that you can't use the thing at all?
You can't. Like right now, there's still zero support.
Linux will see two different directives. And then if you go ahead and software RAID that, then boot to your Windows partition, Windows will go, oh my God, what do you do to my RAID array?
And then it'll rebuild it in the background and wreck everything. So
And then it wrecks your Linux install.
So it's only really an issue if you dual boot.
Huh?
So it's only really an issue if you dual boot, correct?
No, actually, this particular card is not supported, period. Other than flaky binaries. Now, I haven't looked in the last 6 months, but this card is almost 3 years old.
Yeah, and so nothing. And there's a bunch of Adaptex that are like that too. Although there's the AACA RAID driver now, which is kind of pimp. But and then it basically until you get to freeware at like $150 for a two-port card or $100 for a two-port card, that's where you have a real hardware RAID that you could dual boot on, because no matter what, both operating systems are only going to see one big console can drive. This is all on the card.
Right.
Yeah,
I have to plug through a little bit because.
Yeah, hardware RAID is getting cheaper and cheaper, and people want to do it more often because hard drives are turning into weeks, and they get like a 200 gig for
nothing. Let me interrupt real quick.
Why not get another?
The call dropped a little bit on the Skype side here. John, you said you wanted to plug Threeware, and then you dropped out. So can you repeat what you said?
Oh, I basically just said that I've been using Threeware cards, I guess, since. Well, probably the last 4 years, and I've just had great success with them in the Linux environment, though I've actually never dual-booted with one. But they make a great product.
Okay. We continually have been having Skype problems here, and we're not even using real Skype. We're using Skype out to call into a conference bridge, and John, Dave, and Finn are all on, you know, landline or cell phones. So I think this show definitely solidifies the fact that we got to get rid of Skype, and I'll have to start looking into hybrid so I can actually dial in, you know, via a regular phone, and maybe I'll get an ISDN line or something. The quality on this is just unacceptable in my opinion. But sorry,
I think all the glitches are coming from when we're talking over each other, which four people is completely unmanageable, so let's just go nuts.
kind of to follow up and tie up this story and move on, also at NumDex, I was talking to Aza, who was one of the Firefox guys who Finn actually went to school with. And he actually obviously is an open source guy. He worked for Mozilla for, I think he said, like 6 years. So he gets open source. He understands open source. And, you know, more importantly, he's clearly for open source, working at an open source company. And he clearly understands how to make open source successful because he does a large part of their marketing. And I think Firefox is, at least on the desktop side, probably the most successful app open source has ever seen. And he brought up some really good points about problems that Linux still does have on the desktop. And I blogged about some of them. But the interface is still really inconsistent in places. And he pointed out a bunch, you know, just firing up the laptop and kind of going through some things. So I think, you know, some Linux vendors would do well to listen to people like that, that there's always going to be people that complain, but the people that are clearly on our side and can still complain, they probably have a valid point. So we'll tie up that story with that unless anyone has something to add, and Finn will let you move on to your next story or comment, whatever you have.
Actually, I have one last thing to add.
Go ahead.
Broadcom.
yes, Broadcom. The evil Broadcom.
I think we could have a whole discussion about it, Broadcom.
I just thought saying a word that you didn't want to hear, followed by Broadcom. Anyway, okay, that's it.
All right,
I'm done with that. That took a lot of effort, man. I have to do the next story, too.
Yeah, we'll just go in order.
This show is entirely my turn in the barrel. All right. Well, the big thing is I kind of want to go over some of the big industry movements that have happened recently, and then one industry non-movement, because I just want to see what kind of future gazing we can do about one of them. The first big one is, oh my God, holy cow, Apple's going to be running on what?
Mactel.
Mactel, exactly. Mactel, what the heck? But the big thing is, what do you see happening over the next year? Will they phase out PowerPC? Will their sales going to nosedive? What kind of crazy stuff's going to go on? Also, when they actually finally make the switch to Intel, does this mean I can go out and grab a $99 copy of OS X, whatever random kitty they've named it after this year, AMD 64 and boot it?
Not legally.
No.
John, I'll let you go first on this one.
John?
My thing's cutting out a little bit here.
Yeah, I'll let you go first.
Yeah, I'm a Mac user, I admit. And I really don't know what to think about this. I guess I'm not sure. I'm not really sure how how well their protection is going to work against stopping some people from just installing OS X on anything. And if the long term effects of that would mean they go out of business.
No.
Ooh, dissent.
Well, why would you say no?
Oh, it's on me now. Well, no, because I think the reasons that they can't just go on so-called generic Intel hardware is they're political more than technical.
Right.
Microsoft dumped. Now I need some fact checking on this, but I think it was 300 million or 600 million back in 2000, 2001 into Apple.
Who
anybody?
Did?
Yeah. It's I can't remember the figure exactly, but
yeah, it's a pretty big number. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that they need to build competition against Microsoft for that.
I'm not sure John meant even supported by Apple. Did you, John?
Right. No. I didn't mean supported by Apple. I just meant basically. You know, Apple, at least in the past, has always been pretty much a hardware company. That's where they make their money. I mean, they do have a very good OS product, I think, but I still think that in large part it's the hardware that sells the machines. And if they're not making that hardware money anymore, and they're having to directly compete with Microsoft in the software realm, I'm just not sure if they can get enough people to switch.
Oh, no, if they could. I'm strong dissent on this one. In that the profit margins in software are orders of magnitude greater than what you see in hardware, even with boutique hardware like Apple. And
yeah, but just like Dell's not going to ship Linux, they're not going to ship OS X either.
Sorry?
Yeah.
Get
people to switch.
Right. Apple could stay in business selling OS X.
No, but they don't have to. I mean, they already chuck one of their coolest products, software-wise, just at the end user for free, iTunes.
That's far from a free.
And,
at a buck
well,
a song, they make hundreds of millions of dollars.
And well, hold on. All right. Just want to be careful about the talk over. I'm not trying to be that guy. The biggest, Apple's biggest moneymaker recently, it became the iPod. It overtook their hardware sales. It passed that 50% border. And if they continue this trend, and say if they continue to be an opponent not to, say, Microsoft or Dell, but to Sony, and keep going with the nifty little gadgets realm, I mean, don't you see in the future there being all of their money really being in the iPod, the iPhone, whatever new Darwin they might come out with? And my personal favorite, I really want this to happen. I'm begging them, please, take on Sony and build a competitor to the PlayStation 3. Because I want to have an iPhone.
Oh, iPod?
iPhone. IPWN. I want an iPhone. I do not own a current console. I think I got an 8-bit Nintendo somewhere in a closet. But I would buy an iPhone in a heartbeat.
You know, it's kind of funny that you bring up Apple competing with Sony, because on the first show we kind of detailed how I think in 10 years Microsoft will probably not be an OS company but a media company, because I think that's the direction that they're going to go, you know, with Media Center and with the Xbox, and you know, I think they're going to have an iTunes from Microsoft pretty soon. So I'm not sure if Apple's going to go in the same direction. The odd part about this from my point of view is Apple always said that their hardware was more expensive because it was better. You know, it wasn't that x86 crap. It was a real computer. So now I don't see how they can justify.
Beautiful.
I mean, but a slick box is only worth so much money. I mean, I thought a lot.
I don't know, man. There's a lot of bling there.
Yeah, there is. There is.
But they could back the bling up with a differentiator, where now, you know, it's just a white box with a cute case now.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think part of the big problem with sticking with IBM, obviously, was that IBM has just failed to produce any kind of TPC 970, you know, G5 processor that can actually run in any environment without huge cooling and power usage.
Right.
So basically the laptop line is getting so old that they needed to do something.
IBM killed the trend of creating the cooler killer processor with that one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, they don't have a G5 even in, like, beta that can run in a laptop, from what I understand, and that was probably a pretty big sticking point. I mean, from reading around kind of the blogosphere on this one, it seems like there's been an internal argument at Apple for quite a number of years on this one.
Right, and, you know, instantly with Intel chips, you can get Mac Minis and iBooks and PowerBooks that actually have cutting-edge fast processors in them, which IBM just wasn't able to provide.
Okay, now is everybody ready for part two of my question about Apple?
Yeah, I was just going to ask a question, but I'll let you go ahead.
Okay. Well, okay, considering OS X will probably not run on Joe Average x86 machine by default, they're probably going to stick something on it like an EEPROM, like how Open is not Open Firmware. That's
the Sun.
Open Firmware's Sun, right?
No, Open Prom is Apple as well.
Open Firmware's Apple. Ah, Open Prom is Sun. I keep getting the Opens confused. Anyway. And NetBSD is OpenBSD. Anyway. Considering they slap a chip on there, does that mean it's just going to be another modders market? Like, you know, and will involve solder? And the big deal, what's going on in the background there? Basically, what does this mean for Linux in the long run?
I don't think OSX and Linux compete very closely. I don't know about you guys.
Yeah, I mean, and I'm just not convinced that, like, I mean, macOS certainly doesn't make me think I need to drop Linux. I don't know. I think that they're almost saying that two different types of people currently, anyway.
I know, but will they? It's right now. It's white and black. But when it starts getting more gray,
right?
Just mean that people are going to be able to run OS X on your generic stock server instead of whatever, you know, the X serve is really for. I have no idea. Usually, basically, back-ending larger multimedia companies.
Well, hang on. We have a guinea pig here. John, do you run Yellow Dog or some kind of...
I run Gentoo PPC, yeah.
So you run that and the OS X or OS X?
Yep.
Ooh,
I do run both of those on my PowerBook.
How often do you find yourself actually booted in Gentoo?
Yeah.
Well, the one issue has already actually been brought up. It was that ugly Broadcom name. I can't use my wireless networking because Apple Airport Extreme cards are Broadcom-based, and thus I can't use wireless under Gentoo PPC because NBIS wrapper and all that just fundamentally don't work on the PowerPC.
Right.
So I basically only boot into Gentoo when I'm sitting at the desk, which, you know, somewhat defeats the purpose of having a laptop in the first place. That's really the sticking point.
I'm at probably about 70-30 here.
Go ahead.
I also have a Mac, and I'm probably at about 70% Linux. I run Fedora, though, not Gentoo, and 30%.
You have a Mac?
OS X. I've had a Mac for probably a year. I mean, it's not my main desktop. My main desktop is just an x86 box running Linux, but I have an iMac in addition.
Yeah. I think if I had a Macintosh desktop, I think I'd probably be in Linux most of the time. I'm just more comfortable and used to the tools I have in that environment.
I can't get iTunes to run in Crossover correctly. It runs and it starts, and I can buy stuff and download stuff, but it won't connect to the iPod correctly. So I'll boot into OS X to use iTunes every once in a while. Although, to be fair, I haven't downloaded the latest version. They might have fixed it.
Mm-hmm.
So anyone else have anything to add on that?
I think that's what Finnegan brought up. Go ahead, sorry.
No, I was just going to say, does anyone have anything else to add on that?
Well, the Broadcom thing has reared its head twice, and I think...
three times. I heard you mention it on the first show.
I did mention it on the first show.
I was screaming in my living room when I heard, I was like, you bet I do!
Well, I mean, Broadcom is like sort of the Godwin's law of hardware and Linux. It's guaranteed to incite, vile hatred.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm having a hard time thinking of another company I despise nearly as much.
Yeah.
Hardware-wise, hardware-wise.
Well, my favorite is the explanation that I was given unofficially about why they can't release a Linux driver or at least give the specs out.
And
they claim that there's nothing that prevents you from using their hardware on radio frequencies you're not allowed to use. Actually know how their hardware works, which
I've heard that Atheros got around that. I mean, Atheros got around that by unfortunately making the driver never ever available to the kernel because the Atheros, their 802.11g/A chips and multi-chipset comes the driver. Unfortunately, only works x86, but it comes with a little binary HAL layer that restricts you from being able to go into. And the driver won't work with that. It was originally given for BSD, and then they cross-hacked it to work with Linux.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot in the Mad Wi-Fi driver is what it's called on SourceForge.
Mm-hmm.
It's rock steady. It's a great driver. It doesn't work under APM, so it makes my laptop crash, but yeah, whatever.
Well, you see, the vendors have more to lose because if they want to sell in certain countries, they have to meet certain radio frequency guidelines to actually be able to sell as a retail item. I know it's a serious issue up here in Canada. I don't know how regulated it is down there, but as a broadcasting or emitting device, it needs to meet a certain regulatory standard in order to be marketable as an FCC or thereabouts class B device, a home user device.
Mm-hmm.
And when you ship it with drivers where people can... usurp the hardware layer to make it do different frequency hopping and all the other fun tricks you can do, then you can't sell it.
Yeah.
Right.
That's true.
Right.
But, I mean, if you're from 1 to 11, say you don't even give them, I think, is the U.S. go up to 13? I can't remember. No. The U.S. is 1 through 11. Most of Europe and Australia, it goes all the way up to 13, and then Japan is limited to like 14 only or something. If you made a driver that only worked from 1 to 11, you could send it. You could market it anywhere you want, minus Japan. Right?
Okay, yeah, true.
I'll admit that. I have no idea.
Yeah. That's at least B and G. I have no clue. A is 5 gigahertz, and I don't even deal with it because... You know anybody has an A card? I don't.
No.
I don't either.
It's the standard that didn't take off.
Yeah. All right, I'll throw one quick follow-up question on this that I have, and then we'll move on to the next story and get moving. Why do you think they went with Intel and not AMD?
Easy. Did someone else take it up?
Oh, no, come on, man. You swing at the very soft, easy pitch. Go ahead.
Intel has the big R&D. Intel has the market, the branding. And Apple is all about branding and name recognition. Every marketing twitch that you can think of, Apple is there. You don't want to... Apple's never swung with the underdog. I mean, I'm not saying an underdog was really that good. I don't see a need for Apple, who wants to encroach on a broad consumer market, to pick AMD. Because again, it fails the dad test. My dad should have Intel. If I said AMD, he'd be heard.
So you think they're trying to go that far outside of their demographic?
Oh yeah.
Interesting. Because I have to admit, I've traditionally really not liked AMD. I've always bought Intel chips. Over the years, every couple of years, I'll try one AMD chip, and they've always let me down. Until now, in the 64-bit world, AMD is kicking Intel all over the place. I mean, Intel's 64-bit stuff sucks. So I thought if they went 64-bit and went with Opterons, they could still kind of have a differentiator, because most desktops aren't really running Opterons yet. They probably would have raised the price, but not as high as to PPC levels. Obviously higher than the Pentium levels. But I think that's one way they could have switched to x86 and kept a little bit of a differentiator.
The one thing I have to add to John, because you know he just knocked that puppy right out of the park, is mobiles. That's the whole reason that they're making a switch, is because the G5 can't be in a mobile. And AMD's mobile chips kind of suck.
Yeah, I think Steve Jobs just sits there and drools over the Pentium M every night.
More than kind of sucks, actually.
The Sincera rules, and the AMD 64 laptops I've seen have been, you know, large enough to club a baby seal to death.
And it's mostly heatsink.
I think I've only ever seen one.
They're on fire sale. I don't know about down there, but up here, the AMD 64 notebooks, they're on fire sale prices of like $1,100 for an AMD 64 with a compact badge on the top.
No kidding.
No, it's stupid pricing.
I have a Pentium M laptop myself, and along with the IPW 2200, it's just been the greatest Linux laptop I've ever touched. And
yeah,
the hardware,
too,
just,
nice.
And it's only a 1.7 gigahertz. It runs for maybe 3 hours, but it's plenty of speed, and it's a wonderful laptop.
What manufacturer?
I'm a G3 copper line, and it rules. I get about 3 hours off it.
John, what manufacturer is that laptop?
My laptop is an HP.
Okay.
Oh, well, that's really?
Yeah. I mean, it wasn't my choice. It was the one they gave me at work. But it's been great.
All right. Anything else, Finn? If not, we'll move on to John.
No, man. Had a couple more navel-gazing things, but we'll catch up to him later. If we got time.
Oh, you tease.
John, go ahead.
Oh, well, I guess there's two things I wanted to talk about a little bit. I don't know if I'm going to be able to engender as much discussion as Finn did, but I'll give it a try. First thing that I wanted to discuss, I reviewed a new book. They put out a new advanced Unix programming book. Anybody who basically does a lot of Unix programming had the first edition of it by Stevens. They've added an author to it and put out a second version that covers basically multi-threading and network I/O on top of what it covered before. It's an excellent, excellent book. Basically, any question anyone could ever have about a syscall is in there. And it covers macOS, Linux, BSD, Solaris, basically every Unix-style OS, as well as explicitly telling you the differences, what doesn't work, even though it should, on all those OSs, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Just wanted to mention that real quick. The other thing I wanted to talk about a little bit, I don't know how many of you have used the Google desktop search. You guys use that at all?
I haven't.
No, I haven't.
It's basically Google Desktop Search is an app that for Windows currently only, that indexes everything on your hard drive, and it does more than just index file names and everything. It actually understands how to read documents and PDFs and everything like that, emails, chats, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and allows you to search through basically everything on your machine. You know, you pull up a window. It works kind of like Spotlight on the Macintosh. I'm familiar with that. You want to search for something about baseball, and it'll you know, bring up all your pictures, well, that have baseball in the title, or any documents that refer to baseball, or anything like that, and then launch the appropriate viewers to open it and everything. I know a lot of people I work with these days use it extensively in Windows, and I've actually found a product now that somebody's making for Linux that is somewhat a replica of Google's desktop called Beagle. Unfortunately, it's still in alpha, so it is a little bit of a bear to install. It has a ton of dependencies, and they don't have any packaging format that allows you to easily get all the dependencies with it. But I've been using it now for about 2 weeks, and it's working great. Again, it searches through Word documents, PDF files, emails, chats. Just about
that
everything.
Out, John.
It can even read the special tags on pictures if you ever. I'm
the extra
sure.
tags?
Yeah.
Wow.
So it's a pretty. I mean, it still has some problems. It has some bugs, but it also has a Firefox plugin, another big thing. So it'll actually index the web pages you go to. So if you remember having gone and looking, you know, say you're looking for this AMD processor that you want to buy, and you can remember what site you saw, you know, what on, you can search for AMD, and it'll search through all your the web pages you've gone to and tell you all the ones you've been to.
My machine, that would be you need to go through with that.
Yeah, the plugin doesn't always work in Firefox. It's one of the things I think that's a result of the software still being alpha level, but It seems to have a little bit of trouble on my machine with secure pages, especially. But
do you have a URL for that?
Okay. A URL? Give me 2 seconds, and I will grab it for you.
Sure. And do you know who put it out? I mean, was it like a major Linux vendor, or is it just an independent project?
I'm not entirely sure. I saw some things about... I saw some mentioning, I think it's actually a GNOME project.
Okay.
Or maybe it's been accepted into the GNOME group. Actually, you can get to it at Beagle Wiki, BeagleWiki.org is the main page, but it's actually gnome.org/project/Beagle also takes you there, so it is kind of under GNOME's wing. It uses Mono extensively, which is one of the things I find to be one of the more annoying features.
I have to install Mono?
Yeah, that is one of the dependencies.
Yeah, annoying and feature shouldn't be in the same sentence. My laptop only has a 20 gig hard drive, man. I don't think I can hack that.
People seem to really not like Mono.
Huh?
People seem to really not like Mono.
I just was never really convinced we needed a .NET-like interface into Linux.
At the local Vancouver Linux user group Vanlug meeting back in January of last year, one of the Novell guys was up, and he was sort of new on Linux, but he did say something I'd never heard before. He said the Mono was basically an acronym, sort of. For Microsoft, oh no.
I just
look at the whole thing as, you know, Miguel de Acasa being insane, having more motivation than the King people I've met, was bored and was like, what don't we have? That was all that was left.
Yeah,
he worked on the kernel RAID driver, you know, yeah. He wrote Midnight Commander, all sorts of chunks of GNOME. That scares me.
Yeah, it's one of those, like, I always felt, I mean, I guess it's helpful if you're a .NET programmer moving to programming under Linux to have that, but I thought that there was better things to do if you want to do that kind of programming, like use Python or something like that.
Yeah, definitely.
And GNOME seems to be going Mono pretty, you know, heavily in future versions.
Right, yeah, it seems to be very much integrated into the core.
Yeah.
Or looking like it could be very much integrated into the core.
Anyone have anything to add to that story? Next story, no. John.
Fluxbox, eTerms? No, don't really know much about GNOME anymore.
Next story, John?
I'm a GNOME user myself.
You're the local GNOME guy, Jeremy.
I still do use GNOME on most of my desktops, actually. Fluxbox, when I have the chance, but my last two installs have been Fedora, one FC3 and one FC4, and installed GNOME, and I just didn't even have the time to change it. I find myself customizing things less and less and less the busier I get. Before, I probably would have took 40 hours after an install and tweaked everything and changed everything, and now I just want to install things and have them work.
Yeah, I think the reason why I never switched to KDE myself is because it just takes so damn long to compile. being a Gentoo user.
No kidding, man.
I mean, you can compile GNOME in a day. on a pretty poor computer, the same cannot be said for KDE.
Wow, I didn't realize that.
Guess I have to fess up here. My name is Dave, and I'm a KDE user.
I don't have any problem with KDE.
I kind of like it, I don't build it. I just get the latest Slackware build and use that, and it's my sort of my own shame.
I use KDE on my Slackware boxes as well. So.
I have to say that I don't think KDE is better than GNOME. I don't think GNOME's better than KDE. I think they both have strengths and weaknesses. The one thing I do think, though, is that having two desktops that are that popular is definitely going to be a hurdle to enterprise adoption of Linux. Help desks are not going to support them both.
It's a problem. Have you guys seen that as an actual issue?
Well, in the long run, Red Hat, which has kind of moved away from the desktop, it still has what's their enterprise product or their enterprise desktop product again? RES?
RHEL Workstation.
Can't remember the names. Yeah, RHEL Workstation. Red Hat's still a GNOME backer, basically, and SUSE is the KDE backer, and yeah, the dichotomy is there.
Well, SUSE is now as well, and
I think one of the problems that some open source people have with KDE is the fact that Qt is not LGPL'd, it's GPL'd, which is a huge distinction, because it basically means if you want to write, you can't link against it at all without open sourcing your software.
There are commercial workarounds for that, though.
You can use a QPL. You can buy a license from Trolltech.
Yeah.
But I found that seems to bother people more than anything that I've talked to when they come to deciding whether to develop a GTK app or a Qt app.
Yeah, that definitely is a sticking point.
In the commercial landscape, anyway, because they can develop GTK apps all day long and sell them and make them closed source, but same can't be said for Qt apps.
I always found it odd that, Red Hat, like Finn said, Red Hat was kind of the GNOME half, and Novell, SUSE was the KDE half, and then Novell, buying Xeemian, they're kind of a GNOME company, too.
Yeah.
Very GNOME company.
Very, very left field.
Yeah. I wonder how that's going to work out in the long run. I never realized, there was a licensing issue with KDE. Originally, the KDE, nobody liked to use it because the license wasn't anything near GPL.
No, it was the QT license, not the KDE license.
Yeah,
they changed
exactly,
it with QT3. They made it a little more tolerable. QT2 was, people had major issues with.
Right. And QT is actually, or Trolltech, makes QT, is actually going to be GPLing the Windows version completely, I believe, on the next release.
And now Trolltech is also completely free of any oddball legal or financial encumbrance from a certain litigious software company.
Okay, I missed the joke.
Well, the Trolltech was actually, there was some ownership from Caldera, apparently.
Oh, gotcha. Let's not, beat the dead horse again.
No, I'm not just saying that Trolltech has actually escaped that orbit and is now, hopefully, is onto better and bigger offerings.
You don't want to talk about Sco?
Oh, he said it.
God.
Yeah, the Knights who say Sco.
Actually,
sorry.
To,
I will repent my sin.
Where's my pwn club? I know there's a dead horse around here somewhere.
Oh, I'm so uncalled for.
Amazing how little you hear about them these days, even though obviously the case not over. It's kind of just dropped off the face there.
And
I, for one, am glad.
I just refuse to give them any more press than they need.
I would agree. Anything else on that story? No. Next story, John?
Well, I don't really have much else to talk about, though I did kind of think of one other thing when we were talking about the when we were talking about GNOME versus KDE. From a developer's perspective and everything, I actually like KDE a lot more. I think that Qt is a great toolkit. The only thing I've ever used that rivals Qt and its ease of use from a programming standpoint is Carbon, the Mac OS C API. So, throw that out there.
You heard it here first. Holy smokes. Oh, my. Yeah, that's some... because you're a programmer.
I talked to one of the Qt developers at GnomeDex, and he was a really, really smart guy, I have to say. I walked away having a lot of respect for him. So they clearly have some really smart people over there, because he said that most of the people in the office impressed him. So,
There was... At GnomeDex?
GnomeDex has nothing to do with GNOME. It has nothing to do with Linux, actually. It's just it's called the People Aggregator. They try to get a bunch of smart people making decisions in the same room and talk pretty much. But it's not directly related.
Where
to
does
Linux
the name GnomeDex come from?
Yeah.
Chris Perillo puts on GnomeDex, and his site is LockerGnome. So I think a lot of people think GnomeDex has something to do with GNOME, and they're completely unrelated. It was more about like blogging and podcasting and where will the web be in 5 years? Kind of show. It was a great show.
As far as branding issues go, they have some work to do.
Well, if you weren't a Linux person, which is not very many people in the grand scheme of things, when you hear GnomeDex, you wouldn't even know what GNOME was.
Oh, okay.
So
that's why I missed it.
I guess they have to brand it better to Linux people, but generally speaking, they probably don't run into that problem too much.
You mentioned podcast out there. I was wondering if you used the podcasting on iTunes at all.
Do I?
Yeah.
No. I actually just use Bash Potter, which is just a Bash script,
mm-hmm.
because I don't use the Mac too much. So,
yeah, but isn't the podcast available on iTunes now?
Yes, it is.
The LQ podcast is available as of I think about 3 days ago, 4 days ago.
Fresh.
I don't know. It's
although
new,
I didn't see the huge
cell
spike.
Phone thing, man.
Yeah, Finn got a cell phone like 2 months ago.
No,
man.
Welcome
to 1997.
A week and a half ago. First time since 1999.
A lot of people.
My television doesn't even run X. It's just I live a very command line lifestyle. So when you guys started talking about QT, he knows how to shut up entirely. I was like, oh. Man, when I migrate a machine, I just tar the flux box and untar it again. That's it.
Well, you shut up, Finch, John. That's actually kind of impressive.
Yeah, thank you,
John.
Smartass. Wow.
All right.
Jeremy,
right, we'll move on.
My lord and master.
We'll move on to Dave then. First story, Dave?
Well, first for me was, I'm sure you guys all heard my rant on the IRC. I stumbled across a client who was getting a trial on a box that it's a dedicated marine application for fishing. And it turns out that it runs Linux. But I was totally taken sideways. I do a lot of work on boats, and most of my stuff is Windows boxes talking through a certain marine protocol over a very limited marine network over Serial. And this thing just came out of the blue at me.
Is it like an embedded device?
Serial. Sorry?
Is it an embedded type device?
It's not embedded, but it is a. They sell the company that sells it is called Simrad, and it's how do I explain it? It's an appliance that they sell for charting with a certain set of marine charts that does a 3D plot of the ocean floor. And it's based on open source software. Part of it is open source, but I can't quite get the details because it's by a large Norwegian military industrial manufacturer. Essentially, it's just this box that flashed up that the boot screen said Red Hat Linux 8. I was completely shocked.
Yeah, don't network that puppy. Wow.
It had a recent kernel, a 2.4 series kernel. Don't ask me what version, but essentially it was based on a lot of charting software that was built on open source through the Norwegian Hydrographic Service. It's five figures to buy.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Huh.
And I have not had a peek at the actual innards to say whether it's open source or not. Being a defense contractor, they're sort of mum about what's involved and what's inside. But what I found most interesting was that it's sold as an appliance, and it is not marketed as a Linux box. If you go to the Simrad USA website, and look for the CM60, it's called. It's just marketed as the appliance.
I think that's the great thing about Linux, though. It doesn't need to be marketed as Linux. The OS really should be transparent on a device like that.
Exactly. I mean, you boot it, and you see the Red Hat Linux 8 splash screen, and then all the gobbledygook goes by, as the skipper said. And then your charts are up. You're just going. You can't play solitaire on this thing. You can't check your email. It's just an appliance.
What did you say the product number was again?
It was CM, Charlie Mike 60.
Okay.
Made by Simrad.
I'm surprised they didn't put a boot splash over the actual kernel boot. That's kind of.
I was just going to say that.
I would have actually put my company logo on that if I was doing that.
Yeah, no kidding. Yeah, that's good. It's 8 seconds of advertising time lost there.
Yeah, it's elementary. Yeah. The really sick part was that they ship it in a slimline compact desktop with a Microsoft Windows XP Pro badge stuck onto it. Some poor soul paid Microsoft tax. Now that Microsoft tax, compared to about up here, this thing installed after all the smoke clears, you're looking at about 18 to 20 grand.
And this thing isn't like a brand name. It's a total white box, but yet they paid the tax.
Yeah.
Well, it's not a white box. It's a compact.
It's
compact. I didn't catch that. Sorry.
Yeah, it was compact.
Okay.
And it's shipped with, but of course there's no compact on it. There's actually a DOS boot, which looks from first glance to be a free DOS, or it looks like free DOS anyways. So there is no Windows product on it, but yet someone's paid the Windows tax. And that Windows tax is, it's so small compared to the price of the software. It's like when you go to buy that $4,000 or $5,000 suit and that salesman tells you that, $175 tie makes it look like nothing.
Yeah, those nothings add up, though.
They do add up, and I was kind of insulted by the fact that that was there.
I would have at least scraped the badge off if I were that company.
They just don't.
Yeah.
It's just how they ship it. They found one vendor that sold a relatively small. Remember the old compact desktops that you could plunk your monitor on top of?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah, something like that, but black.
Wow.
And smaller.
If it's black, it goes faster.
It does. And racing stripes, always a plus.
Yeah.
But then they had a Lava serial card. I'm pimping my own local vendor here. So this box has four serial ports that can gather data from all the local electronics on the boat.
Four? Good Lord.
Well, you don't need four because you just buy a multiplexer and run all the stuff through one serial port. But I just thought it was really interesting that the farther I dug into this thing, the last thing a consumer would know that it ran Linux. As far as the end user is concerned, it's just a computer that
and it just
has
works.
Charts, and they can click on stuff and zoom in, zoom out, move around the map, and see what's going on.
That's the first Linux like set-top utility box I've heard of. I mean, you know, everybody knows that like basically every fifth Linux's router is booting a 2.2 kernel or a 2.4 kernel.
Yeah, you and I talked about that just yesterday.
Yeah, when Jeremy, one of the great things he scored me was a copy of Linux Unwired, and there's actually, oh my gosh, like the WGRT45, or I know I'm killing that serial number. Basically, Linksys's stock G router. There's four or five sites on the web you can go to, download a custom firmware, boot it, and you're rock and roll. You SSH into the machine, you have a fully functional Linux environment, and it's still working as an access point.
Yeah. And I have customers who have those same Linksys routers that download this stuff, and by the time they're done, they don't know that they're playing with Linux.
Yeah. 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 No kidding.
I think a lot of devices are like that. Most people don't know that a TiVo is just a Linux box, too.
No, I know.
So
or
any
most
people
don't know that
Linux
Google is just a couple hundred thousand Linux boxes. That one really bugs me. People are like, who does this use Linux? You do. Every day you type in Google, your tool.
No.
Sorry,
I'm
off on a tangent.
Next story, Dave?
Yeah, thanks.
Well, my next story is on blogs, and you know I have a small rant on blogs here. The National Post, which is somewhat of a conservative paper up here, last summer ran a story on how blogs are ruining everything for publishers. They're ruining everything for consumers, and that any dimwit can fire up their own blog and publish what they think is true. And it really stuck in the craw of some of my, let's call them Bush conservative buddies, who are few and far between, that people can just say what they want and not be held accountable for it. And now, the National Post has decided that blogs are good. The weekend spread in my $2 weekend paper said that they're not a bad thing and that people can make money at it, so it must be good.
And what's your opinion?
It was a wholesale change that I was not expecting.
Wait a minute, bloggers can make money?
Well, apparently.
A lot of bloggers make money.
I mean, Will Wheaton sells plenty of T-shirts, but, you know, how many others? I mean, Grokwa?
Well, weblogs.inc, I know, employs at least 160 bloggers, just that company. And then if you look at...
No kidding.
I mean, people like Robert Scoble, he works for Microsoft, but really he gets paid to blog. And that's pretty much his job. And he probably gets paid well.
Blogs are also the new AstroTurf, too.
Yeah, but I mean, that's really not a blogger. That's like an eighth of an inch away from just being an op-ed columnist.
But no one knows that. And that's the same complaint that you and I levy against that so-called, you know, paid op-ed columnist was the exact same argument that, I hate to show my colors here, but... it was the argument that the established media was posting against blogs, was that any dimwit could post a blog.
So which side of it are you on? I had a hard time figuring
out.
Sorry? Which side of it are you on?
Well, I'm on the fence here. People can publish whatever they want, and I will lean towards corroboration on a story rather than say that CNN is the source, or Fox News is the source, or my leftist liberal media source is the only way to go. I'm out, for those of you that don't know, I'm out in left coast in Vancouver, and it is somewhat liberal to be nice about it. I've seen people who've come into my shop or the radio shop. There's a guy that's next to me that does radio and radar gear that want to buy a shortwave radio because they believe that the local media, whether it be national, international, or whatever, is programming them to, you know, to believe the party line. And they think that buying a shortwave radio will get the real news.
Wow.
Does the tinfoil hat come with
yeah.
the radio?
Yeah, damn it, man. I was going to...
Oh, believe me. I mean, I see it all. So
I was so going to get the tinfoil hat joke in, and he just beat me to it.
Got to be quicker off the draw.
Yeah,
well,
I know.
No, I mean, blogs, to me, have always been about credibility, and you have to build your own credibility the same way that you build a credit rating or anything else. That because there's... what was the big scandal last year? Who was
Dan
Rather? Was the paper involved in that? Sorry?
You're talking about Dan Rather?
Dan Mathers, yes. And what was the journalist last year, about 18 months ago, wasn't Washington Post, it was the
New York, Times. So you're talking about the guy that just made up his story.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, we all give the New York Times a certain degree of credibility because it's the Times, right?
I give them an incredible amount of credibility. I read more times every day.
Yeah, it's 4.5 pounds of paper in a weekend edition, and you know, we just assume that what we're reading is the real goods. We got fooled. And bloggers...
Well, the New York Times also got fooled, too. And
well, yeah. They did, but bloggers got a bad name last year because people said, well, no one's keeping them in check. No one's saying that... this guy can say that there are, you know, snakes and lizards in the White House and... yada, yada, yada. Well, fine. No one is keeping them in check.
I'm going to disagree with that.
It's the fact that...
Someone is always keeping them in check. I'm going to disagree with that. Someone's always keeping them in check. Other bloggers. There's a sufficient amount of bloggers that if you just post something that's completely untrue, other people will be there to say that it's completely untrue. So,
and that's where I was going with this, is that other bloggers will keep everybody happy. There's no possible way that you can just publish whatever you want to say.
No.
Yes, there are certain sectors in politics, for example, that will preach to the choir, which you know that I've gone way off about. But it's there is credibility in that if you can just publish what you think or what you know to be true. And when someone calls you out, you either A, agree with it, or B, deny it and become a flake.
Right.
I think silence.
Oh, no, I don't know. At one time I was a blogger, and usually I just complained about it. So what does that make me? then I got off that habit, man. That was no fun.
I think I really, really like blogging, I have to say it. And I think the one thing I really like about it is it kind of levels the playing field, where before to get the news out there, you really had to be a, you know, quote unquote mainstream media company like Time Warner or Fox News on the other side of the spectrum there. And so if you didn't get news from one of those two bigger news agencies, you didn't get news. So now the news can come from anywhere, and as a collective, the blogosphere is usually the first one to report on any given subject. You know, if you keep up with a subject on Technorati, I almost guarantee you'll find out something there before you'll find out on CNN or on any news agency or in the Times or the Post or whatever.
One of my favorites is kind of an aggregator of all of them is, you know, Elixir. And
I love that site. Yeah.
It formerly used to be Linux Today because, I mean, they do plenty of their headline or just links to higher profile blogs and then local papers and then national news and then Slashdot. Well, not as much as that. But, yeah.
I guess the thing, too, you always have to keep in mind.
I really want to run this rant, too, is that blogs are editorials. We editorialize. Yeah. We throw our own bias into it, And it's not news. I mean, news is something happened, somebody did something, and there was a conclusion or no conclusion. That's news.
But the person to break the news will often, in this day and age, I think, be a blogger, not a news agency.
Oh, I guarantee it. Right. Because people are just intimately in tune with what's going on. What we used to call, I guess, insider information. But as far as, like, the daily, you know, read 'em blogs, we are all editorializing. And everybody knows their local hometown paper. There's two or three of them, and they know the slant of the editorial board. And the editorial board will publish this and they'll write this to a certain slant, whether it be conservative or capital L liberal or what have you.
Capital L liberal. I kind of wish I knew what that was like.
The problem there is that some big
cities...
I have
to watch the West Wing to find out what that's like.
Oh, the West Wing, yeah.
Some decent-sized cities...
If
like,
you haven't been told, JT and I live in red state shame.
Yeah, it's terrible.
Yeah, well, we do kind of live in a little bit of a... I mean, Atlanta's not exactly super conservative itself.
Actually,
at least not Midtown
nice
where I live.
You're in Midtown. Wow, great. I'm technically in Buckhead. We're in the tiny little blue center in the heart of something much different.
Yes.
Well, one thing I noticed actually after looking at the map was the so-called blue states, they have one thing in common, that the blue states tend to have a lot of international trade going on. They're all coastal, and most of them are coastal or bordering on our Canadian border. They deal with international issues and international people all the time. And I opened up a can of worms there, I'm sure, but...
Yeah, that's a whole separate show there.
Yeah,
I think the complaint line for this one is going to be, Jeremy, my God, they got off topic.
Yeah, we digressed here enough on that one.
Yeah.
So we'll move to the next one.
Speaking of which, Jeremy, you know, one little thing, your blog is way far on the other side. It's just not nearly enough op-ed.
Yeah,
I want to read more, because you have some really stark opinions that are, well, intuitive and funny and insightful and yada yada yada, insert a whole bunch of sunshine, I'm going to blow up your butt right here. So, you know, do more of that. Because right now you're just doing the Reuters, man, or the AP Newswire of Linux. And, you know, we kind of would like to read your opinion. It's cool.
Yeah, Finnegan, you nailed that one.
All right, I'll do more
well,
stuff
thank
on
you.
There. I probably should. You're right. Good point. And actually, Dave, we're going to be doing a show about blogging. I know James Turner agreed to be on, and Doc Searles agreed to be on. So if you want to join us
you're
more than welcome.
I'm busy that day. I'm not sure what day it is, but I'm busy that day. I'm moving or something.
Uh-oh.
I'm helping him move.
Yeah, because that's, like, intimidating. That's, like, that's Doc.
Oh, Doc's a great guy. So anyways, you're welcome to join us, and we'll move on because we've digressed pretty far away from
actually, maybe I should be on that one because I need revenge from the time I got sent off for coffee. I came back to the booth, and wow, there's Jeremy getting his picture with Linus.
That was nice.
I'm standing there just holding a whole bunch of black acidic car coffee going,
the look on your face was priceless.
Was,
all right.
I know. You're
do you have any more stories, Dave?
Sorry?
You have any more stories, Dave?
You know what? I didn't do my homework, so no story. I have no
story. Actually, we're running pretty long. We're at about an hour 20 now. So I had a couple news stories. I'll probably just cover one or two because I really don't want to go over an hour and a half. That's getting a little long to download. I think John touched on the fact that Google currently really only makes Linux or Windows desktop apps with Picasa and Earth and Google Desktop. So on the subject of Doc had posted about a week ago, I think it was, on his blog that while Google had the biggest Linux cluster probably in the world, they really were a Windows company. And I had picked up on that, and I posted to it. And at Linux World San Francisco last year, we got to eat with Chris DeBona, who's the open source guy at Google. So I said...
That was Boston.
Was that Boston?
Yeah,
I stand corrected. No, you're right. Christian, you're right. In Boston, we got to...
At the North-themed Irish bar.
Yeah. So I said, well, you know, instead of pontificating on this one, I'll just ask Chris what he thinks. And most of the conversation, unfortunately, was off the record, so I can't get into all of it. But lo and behold, about 3 days later, after that conversation, they released the Firefox toolbar, which runs on Windows and Mac and Linux. So,
whoa, I didn't know that.
It's written in Zool, so by definition, it'll run anywhere that Firefox runs. The one cool thing I think that most people don't know about Firefox is that the user interface is written in Zool, which is really just JavaScript, XHTML, and built-in images with some other stuff that's simplifying it. But you can actually load the Mozilla interface as a web page in Mozilla. So the toolbar is written in Zool, so it runs everywhere. And I think it's good to see that they're finally supporting Linux. And the one point that he made that I guess didn't cross my mind originally is that, like, Picasa and Earth, which I think they got from Keyhole, were apps that other companies wrote, that they wrote for Windows only, that Google acquired. So you can't expect them to buy a company that writes a Windows only app and then the next day have a Windows or a Linux port. So it's good to see. I don't know if you guys had a comment on that, but I was pretty happy to see a Google Linux desktop app.
Yeah, I think it's a step in the right direction.
Definitely.
Yeah, I mean, after, you know, because we went and, like, hung out at Google last year in San Francisco, actually. And, like, these, I don't know, Noesa from college has another cat that just happens to work desktop support at the Googleplex. And he got us a cute little tour, and they're a pretty solid Linux company in the back end. I mean, it's like every fourth box we walked across was, you know, running Red Hat or some flavor of Linux. And I found it kind of startling that none of their cool, neat toys ran on Linux. I was wondering why, and this actually makes sense now. Because up till then, I was like,
you know, and they do employ quite a bit of Firefox people, so it was a logical first app to release.
And they lent out their one of the entire old SGI buildings they took over to that Mozilla Developers Conference. They print out their T-shirts, you know. They've got a great relationship with the open source community. It was kind of surprising they didn't release more apps for it.
Yeah, one of the other things he pointed out was code.google.com, which has all their open source stuff. They released, like, their Ajax API framework. They released quite a few different APIs and open source projects in general.
Well, shucks. I have to segue back into a certain desktop theme, but I think it should be said that a lot of users don't really care what OS they're running. Am I wrong here?
I don't think you're wrong at all.
No, I agree.
No, I do think so. I think there's a lot of personal identity comes behind OS after a while. I mean, there's a lot. I got a lot of friends that take pride in the fact they're XP. Well, two of them. One of them's a Republican. I won't go there. But all of the Apple users are identified themselves by OS 10. I mean, one of them is like
user people.
That's short away from getting a tattoo. And I mean, these are the guys, the not geek crowd, really. I mean,
yeah, but
you're
into
what OS is running.
You're well into
when
the long tail right there.
Sorry?
You're well into the long tail right there. The vast, vast majority of people really don't care. You care.
I don't care.
OS X users care.
When I ask my dad what he's running, he says, I'm running Office 97.
He's the majority.
Know. I mean, doesn't really care what OS he's running, just the fact that if his friends send him a PowerPoint document, then he can read it.
Yeah, my dad's running the Windows. Not Windows, the Windows. It gets a definite article. I have no idea why. Everything's been the Windows. I'm running the Windows. It's kind of like,
yeah.
You see, this group that we're talking with right now, we all care about that, and we all have a certain feeling about what we should run, but most folks, they don't see the OS. They see the application layer. They see their email.
I agree. And I think the OS should, for the most part, be transparent. There's not a reason, a lot of reason for it not to be.
Okay, then you're getting the son's argument, and I just don't want
to. Yeah. I had about five stories left. I'm definitely not going to get to all of them.
I'll just
highlight a few. The Vienna, quote-unquote, soft migration to Linux, I think is a fantastic thing. And I think it's the route a lot of governments are going to take. I don't know if you guys saw this, but instead of saying everyone's going to run Linux on this particular date, they're saying as of this date, you're free to run Linux. It's a fully supported, you know, you can call the help desk. You have the option to run either Linux or Windows, run what you want. You have the option to run OpenOffice or Office, regardless of what OS you run. So you can do OpenOffice on Windows or go all open source and do OpenOffice.org on Linux. But it's giving them choice, which I think is all any of us really want. You know, none of us want Linux shoved down everyone's throat, but we do want it to be a viable option. So they were saying they have 16,000 desktops, and they think that immediately 7,500 could go to OpenOffice.org and just under 5,000 could go to Linux. Obviously, the numbers are going to be lower because it's not mandatory. But like I said on the last podcast, the day the next insane Windows virus goes around and the people running Linux are working away and don't know what's going on and the people running Windows are running around not being able to do work, the next day hundreds of tickets will go in and those machines will be migrated to Linux. And that will be when the light goes on for a large amount of people. So I don't know if you,
John and Christian, I get off for a rant here again. most of the press releases that we've seen of giant migrations of civic or provincial or federal or whatever you call them down there, migrations to Linux have been nothing more than a threat to Microsoft to get a reduction in license fees. There was Munich last year.
I think Munich got a little bit less genuine when SUSE wasn't a German company. That was my
take. Yeah. But I think this is the first real solid press release that says that Linux is Linux and OpenOffice or not just as much Linux, but just not Microsoft Office is now acceptable. This is the first real news and the first real inroads.
I agree. I think this is a huge story.
Yeah, I agree too.
Finn or John, any comments?
Yeah, I mean, I can't think of anything that's been of that degree of volume. And saying it's okay if you want to play with the penguins. I mean, that's kind of huge, man. I don't know. Yeah.
It was nice to see the action out there.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we just hit an hour and a half, so I'm gonna wrap it up and skip the rest of my news stories. Although I do realize took LQ Bookmarks out of beta, and I just assumed that everyone knew what I was talking about. So I'm going to cover what LQ Bookmarks actually is. The first thing you probably want is the URL, which is bookmarks.linuxquestions.org. And it's basically a site that will allow you to do social bookmarking, tagging, and annotation for open source and Linux-related sites. So it's kind of like Delicious if you've been to that site before. So make sure to check it out, and we are looking for feedback. And that does pretty much wrap up our show. So thank you, John, Finn, and Dave. And thanks for listening, and stay tuned.